Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour audiobiography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers University Newark. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Martin Garbus is a lawyer who has represented people from the very far left to the very far right, mostly in the cause of free speech. Newsweek has called him the most prominent First Amendment attorney in America, and Time magazine said his work is legendary. He has handled cases involving, for example, Spike Lee, Al Pacino, Marilyn Monroe, Nelson Mandela, Michael Bloomberg, Tom Brokaw, Nancy Reagan, and the neo-Nazis marching in a Jewish suburb in Skokie, Illinois. He is writing a memoir in one of those cases with the working title, The Worst Case in American Legal History. That involves a real-life spy story. His philosophy is a simple one. Stifling any form of free speech always puts freedom at peril. Marty, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'd like to talk about a case that everybody says you couldn't win involving Robert Redford.
Oh, Lorillard at that time, many years ago.
1973.
Came out with a cigarette and a big advertising campaign. And the name of the cigarette was Redford. And on the cover of the cigarette package, and indeed in their ads, they had a blonde young man with sleeves rolled up, standing in jeans with the mountains in the background, looking somewhat like Redford. They claimed that they had the right to use that name because Redford was the name of a city in London, in England, pardon me, and that English names were very good for sales of cigarettes. And they pointed out Chesterfield, which at that time had been a great-selling cigarette. And they said that Redford tested out as a name that would be as good as Chesterfield. And I said that you simply couldn't do it. You couldn't use his name. You couldn't use what appears to be a picture. They said it wasn't a picture of him, and that rather it was a picture of the new environment and what people wanted to understand, how cigarettes could be good for you, how it was manly, and that this particular person was created a manly image. And I said, it's preposterous. And we went to court in Manhattan, and they came in and they claimed that they had marketed the cigarette, that no one had come up with the realization that there was a Bob Redford or that the way by their buying the cigarettes. Rather, they claimed that the name Redford had a British magic to it.
And you won. Robert Redford said that he was told by other lawyers, aside from you, that there was no way to beat a big old tobacco company.
Well, we assumed that Lorillard had invested hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe more than that. They had tested the cigarette. They had done a three-year advertising campaign. The assumption is that if they put that much money into it, they're then going to put that kind of money into a litigation. And they started to, but they lost it quickly in the very beginning. We never had to go through a trial. A judge threw it out early on.
Lots of cases, when you read about all of them, and I've read a whole bunch of them, I just can't keep up with them. One that I kind of got a kick out of was Daniel Ellsberg, where you wound up hiding some Pentagon First Amendment papers in your garage.
Yeah, Dan was a friend before he took the Pentagon papers. I met him on an anti-war march in Washington in the early 60s. He was then a hawk. He was then in the Marines. He had then been running up and down hills, shooting what were affectionately called gooks by our soldiers. And then he and I met, and just as his politics were in the process of changing, ultimately he took the papers, the Pentagon papers, from Rand, and then we spent a good deal of time trying to figure out how to get distribution for them, who would see them. Dan went to Gavel. He went to I forget the other Wayne Morse. He went to Fulbright because the senators had immunity, so they could have gone on to the halls of Congress and just read from the papers.
But they which was
the papers were documents which showed that we had lied. The American government had lied to get itself into the war, that the Gulf of Tonkin was not this great surprise attack on American planes, but rather that America had deliberately created a scenario to get us into the war. So ultimately, Dan was prosecuted. I was an unindicted co-conspirator, which means they didn't indict me, but it certainly stopped me from representing Dan. And then ultimately, Nixon tried to influence the judge by offering him a job as being the head of the FBI. Nixon's people approached the judge in the middle of the trial, approached him about becoming the head of the FBI, and the defense found out about it, and that the judge didn't tell anybody until the defense found out about it. And ultimately, that was grounds for dismissal of the case. So Dan's case was dismissed, never to be tried again.
And the New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize for having—
The New York Times won a Pulitzer Prize. And one can argue that Dan is the father of Snowden or the father of Julian Assange, or that he set not a precedent in the terms of a legal precedent, but the whole idea that there was something noble or dignified or decent in showing where the government had misled us, either to get into wars or to do things that the American public did not know about.
He seemed to have a desire to always get involved in the kind of crazy cases that a lot of other people won't handle or wouldn't handle. Am I right?
Well, no. I think, well, it depends how you define crazy.
Controversial.
Pardon?
Controversial when the result is going to get you into trouble, like representing neo-Nazis in Skokie, Illinois.
The way results get you into trouble is awfully hard to predict. One of the greatest troubles, if you will, that I got into, I went to South America, Africa, and I watched the legal system there. This is at a time when Nelson Mandela was in jail, apartheid was running through the nation, and I saw a trial with English judges who were very dignified and very decent, and the things they were doing in the court seemed horrible to me. There was an acceptance of the fact that black defendants would be badly beaten up. They made no attempt to stop it. And I wrote an article in the New York Times and then in the New York Review of Books about the British judges. Now, the British judges were, for many people who wanted apartheid to go, but nonetheless were not extreme, they saw that the British judges were the best part of their heritage. Alan Paton, who wrote Cry the Beloved Country, thought of as a important South African liberal, he and others came after me, including the government of South Africa, claiming that I had no right to say that these judges were either corrupt or incompetent. And they said in court papers filed against me that just like a lawyer could be punished, disciplined, suspended, for telling about, for saying a New York judge or a Supreme Court judge was corrupt and assuming those allegations are wrong, also you should be able to be punished if you said that of other dignified judges.
How'd they punish you?
They tried to have me disbarred, and they brought a legal proceeding in the government of South Africa in the Southern District Court, the federal court in Manhattan, in Lower Manhattan. They brought a proceeding to have me suspended and disbarred. I went around to a few lawyers, and I asked them to represent me. A few lawyers said, "This is, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. This is the South African government. They're going to wear you out." And other people said, "You know, this is your livelihood. You better come up with the money and you better do something about it." I was terrified. I was young. I was in my early 30s. I met a lawyer. I spoke to a lawyer who I just met, a lawyer named Leonard Boudin. Leonard Boudin ultimately represented me, and we got the case thrown out very quickly again on First Amendment grounds. He was one of America's great, great lawyers.
And you were scared.
I was terrified.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Walper on WBGO 88.3 and WBGO.org. Our guest is Martin Garbus, who one journalist described simply as a fighter for the Bill of Rights, whose entire career was defending free speech in America and, as you heard, around the world. I'd like to talk to you about your origins that made you what you are and what you're going to be, because you just won't stop. Born in the Bronx, right?
Born in the Bronx, educated in the Bronx, went to the Bronx High School of Science, then Hunter College, which had just opened up next to my father's candy store. Then I went to the Army. I was court-martialed in the Army.
The court-martial was interesting to me. Even then, you were causing trouble making speeches, right?
Yeah.
What happened?
So the Army, after basic training, sent me to something, an Army information school. This was the time shortly after Korea. And what they were trying to do was to train people like me, people with college degrees, to read the daily news of the Times to soldiers. In other words, soldiers got an hour a week of public information. So I was being trained for that. I just fell into it. It seemed like a nice thing. And then they sent me up to Fort Slocum in New Rochelle to go to this information education school. And at the information education school, it was an eight-week course. You were asked to give three lectures. I gave three lectures. And after each lecture, the Army told me it was objectionable. I was in such a different cultural place than the Army, having come from the Bronx, Jewish boy, etc. And the first thing they found objectionable were things that I had grown up that in retrospect had of a left hinge, but didn't occur to me to have that. The first, I think, was about Sacco Vanzetti, which I thought everybody in school knew about, and I thought everybody agreed that these guys got a bad deal. So I talked about the Sacco Vanzetti case for an hour. And afterwards, the guy running the course, a master sergeant, comes up and says, you shouldn't be talking about things like that. That's not the Army's position. I really had limited understanding of what he was saying. The second time I gave a speech, it was that we should recognize Red China. Again, this is something that didn't seem that extraordinarily controversial to me. The whole question of recognizing them was right off to Korea. They were not our friends, but the idea of recognizing them didn't seem horrific to me. The third speech I gave had to do with the Fifth Amendment. It was a book written by Irwin Griswold, who was then the dean of Harvard, and he wrote a book how people should not be accused of being Fifth Amendment communists or any stuff like that, that people had a right to assert the Fifth Amendment. After that, they pulled me aside. There's a longer story. They told me that I would be court-martialed. There was a court-martial procedure that was set up. I went in, and just because of a miraculous break, I did not get court-martialed. There was a guy called Master Sergeant Hatch, who was at the base, who had been a great hero in the Korean War, and he had been a great hero in World War II. And on a base where there were a lot of people there just feather bedding, he was a real soldier. So he went into the court-martial. I came in to the court-martial. I was alone in a small room like this.
In uniform.
In uniform. I had gone to the ACLU the day before, asked them to represent me. They couldn't. So I went in without a lawyer. There were three young JAG officers, and they would have taken care of me in 20 minutes. He either walked in or was seated there beforehand, and he said, I'd like to excuse Mr. Garbus from the room. Mr. Garbus, please step out of the room. I had no idea what was going out. I stepped out of the room. He then told them that he knew I was being prosecuted because of my politics, and that he said that if he were ever in Korea again, which he hoped he wouldn't be, he would feel lucky to have me next to him, and he'd rather have next to him someone who thinks than is unthinking.
Actually, a lot of the things that you seem to do ran counter to your father, right? You were, your mother died when you were 3 years, when you were two or 3 years
yeah,
old. And your father was from Poland.
My father was from Poland. He left Poland, I guess, in the 20s, terrified. Pogroms were very much a part of his life.
Beaten up.
He had 11 brothers and sisters. 9 died in the Holocaust. His idea was you hide. You be unobtrusive. You be like a shadow. He bought a candy store.
In the Bronx.
Right off the Grand Concourse, the 200th Street, Bedford Park Boulevard.
Small candy store.
Tiny, half the size of this tiny room.
If only we had a camera.
I was back there about a month ago because I wanted to see what happened to the neighborhood, and I wanted to see what happened to the candy store. The candy store stayed there for about 55 years, and in the last 2 years, it became a deli, a Middle Eastern deli. So
things changed.
It was
absolutely
amazing.
He didn't like the fact that you wanted to stand up and shout.
He was very much against it. He was terrified of it. He felt that it would bring the wrath of God on all of us. He wanted me to go into the candy store business. And although everybody from science was going on to college, when I graduated from science, I wasn't going to college. He persuaded me that what could be better in life than to have a cash business where you had $100 in cash every night and you were accountable to no one, and that's what I should do with my life.
What did he say when he found out that you were representing, this was back in 1977, a group of neo-Nazis marching in Skokie, Illinois, a Jewish suburb filled with people with relatives from the Holocaust? Probably didn't like you very much then, did he?
He was horrified by it. He loved me. There was no way that he could comprehend what I was saying. I mean, it was as if I were a Martian speaking to him about something on a different planet. It was just not a dialogue. He just could not understand it. And any first-degree rhetoric or argument that I brought or any constitutional arguments were totally irrelevant to any discussion we had.
You know, the First Amendment, I talk to my wife about it all the time, and she says, you know, what is it? She says, nobody really knows. I don't think anybody in the country really understands it. If you had maybe 30 seconds to explain it, what would you say?
Well, I think any time one now talks about the First Amendment, one also has to talk about something like Citizens United, which is a Supreme Court case which basically said that speech is money, or money is speech, and you can put as much money into a campaign as you want. And if I stop putting a dollar in, then that's my stopping your speech. Now, that's one interpretation of speech that I'm totally opposed to. I look upon speech as, in a way, being a vehicle for a democracy, less something in itself, but rather necessary and incidental to any kind of democratic process. I think what the court did in Citizens United, a court that was committed to allowing money to decide elections, they came up with a construct that's pure nonsense.
I assume that your daughter, Liz, is involved in the same kind of arguments that you got with your father, right? Let's see. She did a documentary called Shouting Fire, Stories from the Edge of Free Speech. And when she has time to talk to you about free speech, you guys get into rather heated discussions.
Listen, I grew up with a certain amount of biases, racial biases, discriminatory thoughts in my head that I had to overcome. My parents had that. Many people from the shtetl had it. She grew up in a world.
What? The shtetl?
The shtetl.
What is that?
You don't know what the shtetl is?
No, that's why I'm asking. What would I, you know? I wouldn't ask if I knew.
The shtetl were small towns in places like Poland. I think that it only referring to Jewish towns, but that may not be true. When I think of something like Fiddler on the Roof, which I have not seen in 100 years, they probably talk about shtetls, small little areas of Jews that ultimately were brutalized and wiped out in World War II. So what I was saying then is, when I come into the world, I come in with many of my father's shtetl biases and discriminations. My daughter, having been educated at a good college in the United States and growing up in a different culture, probably never fought the fights that I fought to straighten myself out. She may fought externally, but internally, she had a set of values that were far more developed than mine.
That's the voice of Marty Garbus, a lawyer whose books and articles cover every aspect of free speech in America and around the world. Right now, he's in the middle of writing a memoir of a case he believes is the worst example of American justice in American legal history.
It's absolutely incredible. The case arises out of Miami at the 1978, when the Bushes, Jeb, the father and the brother.
Jeb was governor.
Jeb was
governor of Florida.
Jeb ran for governor in 94, didn't win. He won in 98.
Okay.
But he was the head of the Dade County Republican Party from 1994 on. He was a very big power broker. He was a bigger power broker than his brother, who was, you know, out in Texas. And Jeb Bush was supposed to be the next Bush who was going to be president, but for some reason he lost in 1994. In any event, there was also a man named Jorge Mascanosa, who was a right-wing Cuban who fought for the CIA, also was involved in the Bay of Pigs, and something called Operation Mongoose.
Bay of Pigs was Americans' ill-fated attack or landing on in Cuba.
And Operation Mongoose, that was 59, the Bay of Pigs. Operation Mongoose continued for 20, 30 years with just endless infiltration of Cuba, blowing up hotels by the right wing, attempting to ruin the Cuban economy.
Pushing fast, pushing ahead, the Cuban Five.
So my clients, it's a complicated story. So my client Hernandez was ultimately indicted. What happened was right-wing planes were flying over Havana regularly. Clinton tried to stop it. The American government tried to stop it. They were renegade right-wing planes. And what they were doing is poking their finger in Castro's eye. They would drop leaflets over Havana. They would threaten that they were going to bomb Havana, which they couldn't. They didn't have the capability. Unfortunately, in February 1996, two Cuban MiGs shoot down two American planes, and four Americans are killed. My client, Hernandez, then living in Miami, is ultimately charged with that murder. So the case is tried in the end of the century, basically, 98, 99. The Hernandez is selected out by the Bushes and the money to be prosecuted because he's totally identified with Fidel Castro, the left, etc. He was a sympathizer of Castro.
Was he an American citizen?
No, he was Cuban.
Cuban.
And the case went on for 7 months. Ultimately, the defendants made a motion for a new trial, saying you couldn't get a fair trial in Cuba, in Miami at that time. You just also had the Elian Gonzalez issue.
Six-year-old boy.
The mother dies on the way in. The father's back in Cuba. The American right wing kind of takes him over in Miami. He comes in on the boat. The mother dies on the trip over. And ultimately what happens is Clinton returns the boy to Cuba. And one can argue that Gore loses the election because of the Cuban vote. Although the Cuban vote is, although only 860,000 people in a population of 17 million are Cuban, half of them go to vote. They have a high registration and a high vote percentage. So they gave Bush a 250,000 vote majority in 2000, which may not be a large number, but you remember the election was won by 537 votes.
What I was interested in is you spent 16 years defending Mr. Hernandez. And finally, what, December 2014?
Right.
He finally received clemency.
Right.
And now he is back in Cuba with his wife, Adriana.
Right.
And was involved in one of the most incredible things I've ever read, something called sperm diplomacy.
Oh, I see. Okay. First of all, I didn't represent him for 16 years. There were some
off predecessors. Off and on, yeah.
But, there were some people before.
Sperm diplomacy. I read that 3-4 times. I read 3-4 articles about it. I had never heard that before. Your secretary, Pat Collins, was said she cried when she read it. So you tell me about sperm diplomacy.
I never heard of it before either. He married his childhood sweetheart when he was in his late 20s and she was a child. He had been in jail now for 16 years. They never allowed the wife to see him. Generally, you have conjugal visits in the United States. They said that the wife was a spy. So they once allowed her into Miami. They kept her there for 19 hours and they sent her back. They desperately want the children. He had a double life sentence plus 15 years, which meant it was unlikely that he was ever going to have a child. Adriana met Senator Leahy, Pat Leahy, and his wife in 2013. And she pleaded with them, saying how much she wanted to have a child. And they interceded. And they helped create a situation where his sperm was frozen, sent to Panama, and she was impregnated.
And now they have a baby. And you cried, and you hugged him. And it's probably one of the great moments in your own legal life.
The baby's name is Gemma, G-E-M-A, which means jewel. And I was with Gerardo in jail, let's say, in November of 2014. At that point, his wife was 2 months away from giving birth. He and I both thought he would never see that child because the American government would never see the child. He thought he might be relegated to having a life with that child on the phone. And it's funny, a child is a blessing, but given all the other pressures you are in jail, this extraordinary blessing could have turned out to be something extraordinarily complicated.
And yet, now that baby is what? 8 months old,
9 months
old.
The baby was born in January, healthy, beautiful. I'm going back there in November. It's a miracle.
It's a miracle. Marty Garbus, thanks for the miracle.
Thank you.
And thanks for informing us about why you keep shouting about fire in pursuit of free speech. We hope your voice will never fail you.
Thank you very, very much.
Joanna Wolpe is the senior producer of our program. Doug Doyle is our executive producer, and Conrad Saguinetti is our engineer. You can listen to any of our other audiobiographies of people whose lives are on the cutting edge, like Marty Garbus, by Googling Conversations with Alan Wolper. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Wolper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.